Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, March 1st, 2015, and this is show number 512. Well, since that is a nice round power of two, we have Donald Burr of Otaku No Podcast on this week's Chit Chat Across the Pond, and he's going to tell us about the maker movement and fun things you can do with Arduinos and Raspberry Pis and more. I guarantee you're going to want to go out and get one of these and start playing with it. It sounds really fun. Now, before we kick in, I want to remind you one last time, this is the last show I'll be doing before Steve and I head off to Dubai, India, and Nepal for 3.5 weeks. I'm excited, and I'm terrified, and I'm excited about the trip. I'm very thankful to Bart, Alistair, and Guy for taking over in my absence. I have every confidence in them that they will entertain and educate in my absence. Okay, Guy does mostly the entertaining part, not so much on the education, but it'll be fun. Anyway, remember, if you have audio reviews you'd like to record, send them in to Bart at podcasting@bartificer.net, and he'll distribute them out to the other people. I know that Stephen Getz got his in early, so get yours going, because you want to make sure yours gets played. Also, remember, there will be no live show for the next 3 weeks. We will be back in a month on the 29th of March. All right, enough of that. Let's get into the show. This week, I had the pleasure to be on Bart's other podcast called Let's Talk Photography at let's-talk.ie. In this episode, Antonio Rosario, Mark Pauly, Bart, and I talked more about understanding the different focus modes on our cameras. A particularly enjoyable part I'm sure you will like is when Mark Pauly explains that my camera can actually do some things that I didn't know it could do. So anyway, I like being on the show because it's like I've got my own little crew to teach me how to take photographs. But it's really interesting learning about the different focus modes and how they work on these new fandangled kind of cameras that we have. Anyway, go check it out over at let's-talk.ie. Well, I love to read, especially on my Kindle. Like many of you, though, a part of me misses real books. I miss going to the bookstore and judging a book by the cover. I mean, come on, seriously, that's what we all do, right? I miss trading in my books, my used books, to Dave's Old Bookshop and getting store credit to buy more used books. I miss having friends hand me books at the gym that, you know, the books they loved, and they go, "Oh, Austin, you got to read this. It was amazing." Book discovery was easier for me back then. I miss the library. But I got to tell you, there's a lot I don't miss about real books. I don't miss those paperback books that had the binding too tight, so you had a hard time reading the inner edge of a sentence, and you'd swear from now on, I am only buying Penguin books because they have easier bindings. I don't miss reading the beginning of a hardcover book when I'd lay on my side and the whole weight of the book was on top, or the end of the book when it flipped the other way. I don't miss the weight of carrying 5 books on vacation. I don't miss finishing a book and realizing I don't have a new one with me. I don't miss reading books where the text was too small. I don't miss having to read with the lights on, keeping Steve awake. For me, the benefits of electronic books win out. I started reading electronic books on my iPad a few years ago, and I loved it. But then I got my first Kindle, and I never went back. 2 things pushed me to the Kindle over the iPad: the lightness of the device and the complete lack of distraction it offered. When I use my iPad to read, I simply cannot stop myself from checking Twitter. I just can't do it. It's funny. Having a single-use device really, really works here. With the Kindle, it does one thing and does it well. I didn't jump on the Kindle bandwagon early. My first was the second version of the Kindle Touch, which I think was the 5th model of the Kindle. I upgraded to the Kindle Paperwhite after that, and now I'm sporting the Kindle Voyage. The jump from the Kindle Touch to the Paperwhite was huge. The brightness of the backlight made it so much easier to read, and it was a lot faster. Steve and I handed down our Kindles to our kids, so, you know, we felt justified getting the newer models. I have to say, though, if you have a Kindle Paperwhite, the jump to the Voyage is not nearly as big as people say. You know, it's pretty, and it feels nice, but people describe the look of the text as being amazing, you know, like going to retina from non-retina. I sure wouldn't say that. Steve and I put the Voyage side by side with the Paperwhite with the same book, and we could barely tell the difference. The Voyage has a spot on the bezel where you can squeeze to turn the page, but it's a lot harder than just swiping on the screen like either one of them can do, even if you adjust the settings to be the easiest to press. We still justified the purchases, though, by handing out our Paperwhites to the kids. We did it for the children, you know. Another consideration in choosing a Kindle is cellular or not, and ads or not. My first Kindle had cellular capability, but I have to admit that never once did I have a book-related emergency that could not wait for Wi-Fi. I do hate to be without a book, but even I could look that far ahead. I also choose the Kindles with ads. The way they're described, you'd imagine that you'd be reading along, suddenly when you turn a page, there's an ad. That's not how it works at all. There are only ads on the static page when you turn the Kindle off, and just recently they've also included a small ad when viewing your list of books. Most of the time, they're advertising books anyway, so they're even useful ads. There's a lot to love about reading on a Kindle. I love being able to make the text small or large depending on my mood and glasses of the hour. I love having the backlight on for nighttime reading. The Voyage has a setting where you can have the light slowly dim after you shut off your room lights. That makes me really happy. I love being able to flip the page with a gentle flick of my finger. You know when you're cold and you don't want to pull your arm out of the covers to turn the page? You can just tap it and move on. I love sharing an Amazon account with Steve and my kids so we can share books. I love how I can touch on a word and get a definition. I love it when I think, hey, that's not a real word. And the Kindle's dictionary proves me right. I am almost always right in that kind of thing. I actually have a pretty good vocabulary. I love being able to buy books on my Mac and have them instantly sent to my Kindle. I love how if I'm out and about and I get stuck somewhere, I can open a book on my iPad or iPhone and pick up right where I left off on my Kindle that's sitting at home. That whisper think thing is really cool. One time, Steve forgot his Kindle at Lindsay's house, so I just let him use my iPad to read until we had a chance to get back. It's not all happy, happy, joy, joy, though. I find the Kindle menus really confusing and slow to navigate. In my ideal world, I would be able to categorize my books, maybe even having tags or other metadata. I can picture read versus not read, or who told me to read a book, maybe a tag for a read right away, and one that says read when you're desperate. Instead, I have on device and on cloud. To be able to tell which ones I've read, I have to look at each book and see if the little dots go all the way across the bottom. Now, if I loan it to one of my kids, or one of my kids reads it, those dots are going to change anyway, so that doesn't help. They do allow you to create categories, which are kind of like folders, but creating them and moving books into them is tedious and confusing. I originally thought you could only put things in one category, but luckily I posted what you're hearing right now as a blog post before telling you about it, and Michelle York commented on the blog that at least on her Kindle, she's able to put books in more than one category. I tested it, and she was right. That was a big breakthrough. As far as I know, though, these categories only apply to on your Kindle, not to books in the cloud. I have 92 books in my library, and even via the web, I can only view them by when they were purchased or alphabetical order. That's it. Especially with sharing of an account, this thing is a big mess and I can't figure out how to organize it. Over time, it's only going to get worse. I kind of feel like a hoarder, you know, surrounded by piles of books with no order to them. I also really, really miss the ability to flip back through a book to try to remind myself of something I've read. For example, I'm reading a book right now that has a lot of very colorful and interesting characters, and they're all related. There's grandmas and daughters and granddaughters and mothers and fathers and kids. It's a big mess. But I can't remember, is Margie Veronica's mother or grandmother? I get confused. If I were reading this as a paper book, I could easily stick my finger to hold my place and flip through the pages till I found where they explain that relationship. I know, with an electronic book, I could place a bookmark and I could tap, 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 or choose the go to a page to try to move by a chunk of pages, or even use search, but neither method is efficient for skimming to find something. I really miss having people hand me books they love. I know there's book clubs online, but I haven't yet done a good job of joining any of them. I'm in Goodreads, but I haven't invested the time to put in the good books I like and the ones I didn't like so that I can find my tribe. I really do plan on doing that someday. If anybody has a suggestion for the best one they found, if they're really good at reading and they like to do this, let me know. I should mention that people do still hand me real books, but I actually can't stand reading real books anymore. I miss the idea of real books, but I think I don't actually miss real books. I felt badly, like my brother bought a brand new hardback book and paid to mail it to me. I didn't have the heart to tell him I was going to read it, so I snuck out, bought it on Amazon, and read it on my Kindle and never told him. He was never the wiser. I'll tell you the worst part of reading electronically, though. Books end early. The Kindle gives you a couple of ways to tell how far you are into the book. You can see a page count, but it changes depending on how big your text is. If you have really wee tiny text, you have fewer pages, right? That makes sense. You can see what percentage you are through the book, which I find much more useful. But sometimes the book ends well before 100%. Now, I know that does happen with real books, but sometimes it's because of an index or it's a preview of another book. And somehow in paper books, it didn't seem to happen as often. I know it did sometime. They'd be like, the next book by Janet Ivanovich. She was notorious for that. So, I don't know, maybe it's because bits are cheap, so including all that other glop is easy. The worst case of this happened to Steve. He was 50% through a really good book when it suddenly ended. The second half was a totally different book by an author he had never heard of. Can you imagine how annoying that was? I mean, I'm sure the publishers thought, hey, we're giving him a free book. He's going to be really happy about this because he had this whole other book. But he thought he was halfway through a really, really good book and all of a sudden had nothing left. Really, really was irritating. Another problem I had was I read the book What If by Randall Munroe. He's the comic artist who does the XKCD cartoons. It's a fantastic book. It's really, really good. But it was horrible to read on the Kindle. Munroe includes cartoon illustrations in his books, but the Kindle operating system simply can't handle them. I tried to turn the page, and it would do nothing for a really long time. I actually thought my Kindle was failing because the experience was so bad. In addition, the drawings were so tiny, I couldn't even read the captions anyway. I could make the text of the books, you know, an inch tall, but the drawing stayed the same size. So I didn't get the jokes, and the reading experience was dreadful. I'd avoid buying any books with graphics, even stick figure cartoons, if you're going to read them on the Kindle. Back to things I like about electronic books. Years ago, I posted how angry I was with the publishers that the price of ebooks wasn't significantly lower than the price of paper books. You know, with paper books, you have so much waste, they have to be more expensive. The publisher has to guess how many books to print, and all of the ones that don't sell still have to be shipped and later disposed of or moved to the bargain bin. You have to cut down trees, for crying out loud. You have to print and box and ship and put on shelves. You know, space on shelves costs money, too. I know as well as the next guy that storing digital bits is not free, but the cost to keep a book ready to be downloaded by me is a heck of a lot less than having it sit on shelves on the bookstore. The good news is that ebooks have gotten a lot cheaper. I rarely pay more than $6 for a book these days. And if you're clever at all, it's really easy to find books for $2. Heck, there's a ton of classics for free because they're in the public domain now. I finally read Wind in the Willows for the first time. I'm reading more books than ever before because of electronic books, but I think I'm overall spending more because I buy everything. Stay tuned for part two of my reading saga, all about the library experience I had with electronic books. I'm going to talk more about reading books on the Kindle in a few minutes, but first let's listen to two more CES interviews, The Gift That Keeps on Giving. I was walking past the Wonder Workshop booth when I saw an odd little robot running around on the ground. It looks like four blue balls. It's got an eyeball. It was driving around. And so I decided to talk to Vikas Gupta about it.
Hi, I'm Vikas Gupta. I'm one of the founders and the CEO of Wonder Workshop. And this is Dash. We designed robots Dash and Dot to help kids as young as 5 and to any age above that to learn to code and have a lot of fun.
Learn to code with a robot.
That's right. So the robots come with four applications that sit on an iOS device like an iPad or a tablet. And using those applications, kids can program the robot to do anything they wanted to do. And it ranges from something that kids don't even need to read or write, to the level where they can do using visual programming languages like Blockly. They can program the robot and have access to all the capabilities of the robot with very simple tools.
I missed, what language did you say they're writing in?
It's called Blockly, which is a visual programming tool.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
But you say before they can read or write, they can still program?
Yes, that's right. We have application that before even kids know how to read or write, they can use visual tools to program the robots.
Oh, I like it. I like it. So can you show us it doing something here? All right, he's grabbing another one of these that has it's got a xylophone attached to it.
So this one is an accessory that comes with a robot that you can buy in addition, and it attaches to the robot. And I'm going to use an application to program the robot to play music. So I'm going to connect wirelessly to this robot.
So he just held a button down, and it's talking to the robot, evidently.
Yep. It looks like I'm connecting two robots at the same time. I'm going to fix that.
So he's pressing and holding on a button that says Mason. All right.
But this is really a programming tool as well. So I can start tweaking this robot's code in real time, and the robot will keep responding to that as I change it. handle, I'm actually happy with.
He's tapping on a diagram that looks like the xylophone, and he's moving the dots around. It's changing what the robot's doing.
Yeah. So the goal is to make music the language or the coding language. So the kids are coding, but they don't even realize they're coding. And it's a way for kids just to draw the kids into the world of coding by making it a lot more fun than it has been ever before.
Very, very cool. And when do you expect this to be available?
It's already available. We've already shipped about 30,000 of these robots to customers around the world. People can buy Dash and Dot on our website, makewonder.com, and also on amazon.com. They're available now.
All right. And how much do they cost?
Dash is $199, and Dash and Dot together are $259.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, I'm not sure this toy will make your kid be the next great developer of all time, but I think every toy that helps educate while being fun is a good idea. And if it starts stimulating ideas, that's better than, mindless watching of TV or something like that. The next interview is with the Osterhout Group, and this was probably the most enjoyable interview that I did at CES. This guy was hilarious. Now, it might be more visual, so you might need to run over and watch the video on, we've got a link to it on podfeet.com, the guy was just hilarious. I just had the best time. So let's see how this works in audio.
Are you ready?
I have absolutely no idea what is going to happen in this interview. We've been laughing for about 10 minutes here.
Oh, it's going to be good. You're going to like it. It's going to be fun.
All right. Well,
it's going to be fun.
Steve Jamison from ODG stopped us and said we had to look at his glasses.
Hey, I have to look at my glasses. They're very cool. So basically what this is a high-end tablet you wear on your head. So It
doesn't look like a tablet for the audio-only listeners.
It does not look like a tablet. What it looks like is a pair of wraparound sunglasses. Can you see that? Yeah. And basically it has a... We have two versions of this. This is targeted to the government and industrial folks, right? So people that are working on aircraft carriers and are forward deployed and working on mine shafts and on oil rigs and all kinds of crazy stuff. They're augmented reality glasses, and they behave just like a tablet, except for you can see through the images, see around the images. You can also see stereoscopic 3D 720p. That's pretty
cool.
Okay,
so wait a minute. So I'm like reading an email while I'm working on a mine shaft?
No. So I'm working in a mine shaft, and my drill is broken, and I don't know how to fix it. So I put these glasses on, and I look at the drill, and it recognizes the drill and pulls up all kinds of checklists that I can see, right? But my hands are free. So I can start to work on the drill, and it walks through the checklist. If I find something that's weird, right? This has got Wi-Fi and Bluetooth, right? So I can send the video, 5 megapixel, 720p, 60 frames a second video. I can send that back to the expert on the surface, and he can be seeing what I'm seeing. And because I have stereo audio with magnetic ear jacks, I can hear what he's saying to me, and I know how to fix this.
Magnetic ear jacks, that just sounds good.
Magnetic ear jacks. Doesn't that get you going?
It really does. That's good stuff.
Get me going, doesn't it? Yeah. So I'll give you a quick overview, okay? So... high-end tablet, Snapdragon 805 quad-core processor for all you techies out there.
Yeah, 2.7
gigahertz, 16 gigabytes of internal memory, 1,300 milliamp hour batteries.
I was going to say, in a 4-minute battery with all that?
Oh my goodness, it lasts a long time.
How long's it last?
So it depends on what you're doing. It works very similar to a cell phone battery. So if you are surfing the internet with a browser, or you're doing your email, or you're watching a movie, or you're listening to music, or you're reading a book, it'll last for hours, right? If you're doing augmented reality, like the mine example that I just talked about, and you have the camera going, and it's tracking what you're seeing.
And Wi-Fi and Bluetooth.
And Wi-Fi, and it's sending stuff back, right? And it's putting augmented targets on that drill, right? Then it's going to take some battery power, right? So it'll last an hour or two, but that's okay, because you just plug this bad boy in, see, with the magnetic USB connector and an external battery, and you're going for days, right?
Very, very cool.
You're going for days.
So do I get to wear them?
You want to wear them?
Absolutely.
Okay, so let me ask you a question. You have glasses on.
Oh, I can see without them. I'm also wearing contacts.
So are you really glasses and contacts? You're doing double duty here.
I really like my optometrist.
So let me ask you a question, though. What's your prescription?
Minus 1.75 or something in one eye.
I'm going to hook you up. Only one eye. Only one eye?
Yeah, but I've got those contacts on, so don't give me that.
All right, but if you didn't have the contacts.
You need to give me clear.
If you didn't have the contacts.
I'm just nearsighted.
So I would take one of these corrective lenses, and I would snap it into the glasses.
Oh.
And it would correct both the displayed digital image as well as the see-through. And you wouldn't have to wear your glasses, and you wouldn't have to wear your contacts. But because
Very
you
cool.
don't need it, I'm not going to put them on for you.
Okay. But that's cool. So corrective vision's taken care of.
Corrective vision is taken
care of. All right, so I'm going to take my regular glasses off here, right?
Yep. So basically, I'm going to put this on your head.
Okay.
And what you're going to see is a row of icons floating in space.
All right.
All right.
Okay, now you have to hold the mic.
I have to hold the mic. Hold it close to me. All right. This is Vegas. Should I sing like Elvis? Or? Okay.
Right.
So now, can you see a row of icons?
Yep, I see icons out there.
Pretty cool, huh?
Yeah.
All right. So
I can still see Steve.
Hi, Steve.
Oh, I can still see you.
Still see me. So up on this temple, there is a little cursor. Do you see the icons rolling back and forth? So you try it. Move it this way.
I'm not sure I found it yet.
Right there.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
Okay, so you see those icons? They roll back and forth?
Yeah.
Okay, go way to the end, and there should be a movie icon.
Okay, I'm getting there. Panorama 3D movie?
Go one more.
GoPro movie.
GoPro movie, okay. Now click on top of that thing.
Okay.
And did it start the movie?
It just started. I'm skiing.
You're skiing. That's cool, isn't it? It's cool.
Damn, I'm skiing.
So what you're seeing
is... I don't like that jump coming up.
So that's 720p, full-color video. Very, very... And it's great quality, don't you think?
Yeah.
Can't see any pixels.
It's really bright.
Really, really bright. And you can see around yourself, so you're not occluded from your environment. You still know where you are. You're still very plugged in. You understand what's going on around you, but you can... that contact's cool. All right.
That is very cool. Let's see if we can get Steve to see that through the glasses.
Steve, you want to see the glasses?
All right.
Steve, let's see. Steve.
All right, so you want to press the button for Steve?
Sure, it's already going, isn't it?
Okay, no, it's the movie stopped. Okay, we've got Steve is about to put the camera into the inside of the glasses.
Oh, so Steve's going to, through the magic of television.
Through the magic of television.
All
Steve's
right.
going to put his camcorder inside the glasses. It is short.
Here you go, Steve. All right, can you see that? 720p.
There we go.
60 frames a second video. High quality, beautiful, high-end tablet-like.
You can see my hand moving around too, right?
Yes, I can. That is pretty cool.
All right. Enough?
All right.
Cool. All right,
that is enough.
I'm going to show you some more. You want more?
Okay, a little bit more.
All right, how about 3D?
I gotta love some 3D.
All right, you're going to like some 3D. Hold on. For the sake of time, I'm going to do this for you. Okay? All right. So I'll take this. You put that back on. All right, so you...
Movie?
No, it's already playing.
No, it isn't.
Oh, it's not?
You're lying.
Oh.
I'll hit it.
Yeah, you hit it. I'm sorry, I thought it was already playing. Do you see the White House?
Yes, I see it.
All right, so basically what you're seeing is 720p, stereoscopic to each eye.
Oh, wow.
All right, so this is real 3D. Now tell me when the champagne hits your hits your glasses.
Oh, no. Well, right now I got bread coming at me.
You got bread coming at you.
I got a toast.
Yep. All right. Yeah, be careful now.
All right. Now
be careful.
We're in the kitchen. We're washing some... Oh, I got a crab coming at me.
Okay. I want to...
You're a sucker now.
Wait until...
This is champagne.
All right, now it gets good. Wait till the fruit comes. You're going to love the fruit. You're going to reach out and want to bite that fruit.
Okay, this is just crazy.
Isn't that cool?
That is very cool.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right.
You guys were fun.
How can people find out more about this?
So you go to osterhoutgroup.com.
Can you spell that?
I can hold it up.
Oh, we can do it on the lower third here.
Oh, you can do it on the lower third?
Yes, we'll put it on the movie.
Oh, you'll put it on the movie.
Yeah, we've got it. All right.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
That was fun.
That was fun. Thank you.
Well, if nothing else, you can tell I enjoyed myself. Well, let's get back to books. The one thing I still can't crack the code on is how to get books from the library. I know people far less tech-savvy than me who have it all figured out, but it still baffled me. Here's the problem. The electronic connection to my library clearly was written by database administrators, not people who read and love books. Let's back up a little bit and talk about how normal people go look for books. I think once in a blue moon, you go to the library or bookstore and you think, I'm going to get The Shining by Stephen King today. Most of the time, I think you just spend time browsing the aisles. You're like, I need a book. You go and you just start walking around. Maybe you start in fiction and you stroll through looking at the bindings for names of authors you like. You open a few, you read the first few paragraphs, and then you weigh the book to see if you have the energy to read the whole thing. All right, maybe that last part's just me. But anyway, after you've done this, say you're in the Stephen King wing of the library, but then you notice Barbara Kingsolver is right next to him. Wonder what she's about. And suddenly you're going home with an even bigger book, The Poisonwood Bible. Let's walk through how my online library works in comparison to that physical experience I just described. I start a Google search for my city with the word library in it. I get a website that looks like it was written by hand in 1992, maybe? No animated GIFs, but it's almost that bad. I can't even find the word books on this website. Then I find something that evidently is a button, but is not styled that way, called the catalog. When I click on the catalog, I'm taken to quick search. Okay, this is awesome if you're looking for Stephen King or The Shining, but how do you browse, say, fiction? Can't figure out how to do it. Well, they have a couple of sections that look helpful but really aren't. There's a section for what others are reading with hottest titles or hottest author. Guess what happens if you look at the hottest titles or hottest author? Those are going to be the books they don't have, right? Because they're the hottest ones. Nobody, it's like they're driving you to the thing you can't have. They have a section for hottest subject, but the hottest subject was large type books. Guess that says something about our aging population now, doesn't it? Wait a minute, didn't I just complain about how the text is too small in books? Well, anyway, so how about bestseller lists? They've got that. They've got the New York Times bestseller fiction. That sounds fun. There are 15 titles and none of them are available. Some of them say buy now and take me to their Amazon affiliate link. Well, you know, if I wanted to buy a book, I would have started in Amazon. I can't blame them for trying, but still. Here's another problem. Let's take a look at the number one book on the New York Times bestseller list for fiction. It's called The Girl on the Train by Paula Hawkins, and it has a link to details. So I clicked on that. Now, remember, back to your bookstore scenario, you're looking at a book. What would you hope to see under details about a book? Speaking of someone who might want to read, would you want to know a little bit about the book, maybe? What's the basic plot? Nope, they don't tell you that. They tell you the publisher, the publication date, the number of pages. Okay, that's a little bit useful. And the 14-digit ISBN number. That was my favorite part. That's why I say it's like it's written by database people, not by people who read. I do have to concede one point here. They did have a link to nearby items on shelf. You know, clicking that took me to authors whose names were near Hawkins, just like my real-life example with Barbara Kingsolver and Stephen King. I'm going to take a quick break to mock the library for something else. You've heard the term before, security theater, right? Well, in order to work at these libraries, books that I can't have, I have to log in with my library card number and my double-secret password. Guess what my password is? It is assigned to me. It is the last four digits of your home phone number. In case you forget, it tells you right on screen, if you forget, it says, it's your phone number. Your password is your phone number. Okay, now that wouldn't be so bad because this is not the crown jewels as Bart calls them, right? But here's the theater part. If you leave the website alone for a little while, it logs you out. That actually made me laugh. All right, back to hunting in my library for the first glimmer of hope of getting a book onto my Kindle because I'm not even close yet. You'll have noticed something else is wrong with this entire process. I'm not actually in electronic books yet, am I? I found another section called Find It Fast. It's so poorly done, I'm not going to take you through the agony, but at least in there, they show a symbol of a real physical book or a musical note next to it to tell you whether it's physical or an audio book. That was the first time I realized I wasn't even looking at electronic books. I was looking at physical books. So this is the point where I've given up in the past. This is what would always happen. But that friend of mine from the gym was so mocking that even she had figured out how to get library books on her Kindle. I had to crack the code on this. All right, I went back to the Googles. This time, I searched for electronic books followed by my city library name. One of the first hits was a lovely news article all about how my library now uses a service called Overdrive to rent out Kindle books. All right, now we're talking. Notice I'm not at the library, but a news article about it. So I click the link to Overdrive, And it takes me back to that original cryptic book from my library. But now I notice in about 3-point font under digital materials, it does technically say e-books. Maybe if I'd done a search instead of trying to use my eyes on that horrible, eye-burning 1992 website, I would have found it. Anyway, I clicked on e-books, and that gave me a link to another site altogether, to Overdrive. Now maybe I'm getting somewhere. The good news is that Overdrive looks like it was developed by someone who actually had UI design experience and might actually read books. I figured out how to log in with my library card number, and there's a button. Oh, and my double secret 4-digit phone number. Right, don't forget that. Highly secure. Anyway, once I got in, there was a button for fiction, mystery, and suspense. At first, I was thrown because every book I clicked on said, place a hold, which I guess is how you reserve a book. But then I explored the nicely laid out filters on the left, one of which said the most beautiful words, available now. It was a miracle. I was able to filter by Kindle books as the format, and the Kindle itself was my device, and now I had 1,290 available books from which to choose that could actually go on my device. I was beside myself. It was a reading miracle. Think about what it was like without this. It was like if you walked through a library where they put out fake books where the real books would be if they weren't already checked out. I followed the directions to borrow a book and download it, curious to see if it would deliver the book to me or how it would do that. I assumed I'd have to hardwire my Kindle to my Mac and use some janky third-party tool, but instead, it simply took me to Amazon's interface with an option to send it to one of my 26 different devices capable of reading a Kindle book. It was delightfully easy. Now I see why my other friends actually like reading books on their Kindle-capable devices. I mentioned this to my friend at the gym, and she said, oh yeah, did I forget to tell you about Overdrive? I'm like, yeah, you did. And I said, well, and how did you know about Overdrive? And she goes, somebody told me. I've taken you through this long, torturous journey as I've spent literally hours over the last few years trying to figure out how to borrow a darn book from the library. Maybe there's an easier way to get there than my particular path, but I'll give you a hint. Go to overdrive.com and hope your library supports Overdrive. I'm so glad I started making blog posts midweek because I can post these, people read them, and some people get a chance to respond to them, which makes the information richer for the rest of you. Like when Michelle York explained that I was a big fat dummy about how categories actually worked on the Kindle. But this week, I posted both of those book reading stories, and Hai Vu posted on the one about finally figuring out how to borrow books from the library on my Kindle. The cool thing is that he posted a clarified tutorial he had made on how to use Overdrive in order to put library books on your Kindle. Boy, that would have been helpful if I'd known it before I wrote it. Anyway, wouldn't have had any material for the show. I'm pretty sure he must have done this earlier for folks that live near him, because the example he uses is for a Seattle-based library called Snow Isle. I can see from his tutorial that his library has a nice button that clearly says eBooks and More, unlike my 1992 library interface. If you click on eBooks and More, he shows in his tutorial that there's a giant Overdrive logo. Wow, that would have been cool if I'd had that on mine. Once he takes you through to Overdrive, he gives you a great view of how to filter for books using sequence numbers on his screenshots and how to look at your bookshelf personalized in Overdrive. I love that Hai did this for his own friends. Even better that he got dual use out of it with the tutorial for sharing it to us. Of course, I put a link in the show notes to Haivu's great tutorial on clarify-it.com. If you know a lot of stuff like Hai and enjoy helping other people, and more importantly, enjoy helping them once and not having to answer the same question over and over again, consider trying out Clarify from clarify-it.com and tell them Allison sent you. Maybe your tutorials will get featured here too. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond, and back by popular demand is Donald Burr, the man of the hour. How are you today, Donald?
Not too shabby. How about you?
Good. So for anyone who hasn't heard Donald before, I know we have new listeners all the time. Donald is probably one of my geekiest guests that brings in some crazy stuff with a good sense of humor, and I always look forward to having you on, Donald. Like you said, you always have something up your sleeve to talk about.
Oh, yes.
So the reason I asked you on the show this time was I saw a you sent me a video of a 5-minute talk that you did at Scale at the Southern California Linux Expo, where your initial chart said problem to be solved, and you had my logo on there. That was great.
Yeah, I wanted to give you a plug. Unfortunately, this is one of those lightning talks where you only get 15 seconds per slide, and I had audio problems, which kind of flummoxed me, so I lost my timing.
Oh, no. I thought it was a fantastic talk. It was very good. But it was you've been getting interested in this whole Maker thing, right?
Yes, I have. And, you know, it's something that I've actually been wanting to talk to you about for a while. And, you know, this is a perfect opportunity.
Why not today? All right. Where should we start?
Well, let's start at the beginning. I mean, what's the whole point of this Maker thing? You know, the way I see it is it's kind of like giving a way to move your computing activities into the physical realm, you know, being able to, we have these great computers on our desks. We can, you know, do all sorts of cool things, making podcasts, doing videos and stuff. But, you know, that's all in the digital realm. You know, this is a way of getting people being able to, you know, move your creativity into the interacting with the physical world, you know, making objects, you know, that do, you know, cool things and, you know, maybe even actually solve some real life problems.
So do you think part of this has come about because we're frustrated because we don't take our computers apart anymore and build them by hand?
I think that's a lot. That's a lot to do with it. Yeah.
They work too well. So let's find something else to mess up. Right.
Something like that. But, you know, also it's just, you learn a lot. You know, it's something great to do with, you know, your kids or your friends and stuff. And it's just a lot of fun.
Well, that sounds cool to me. So what do you need to get started?
So first thing you want to start with is you got to learn your electronics basics.
Okay, and I'm out.
Yeah. it's obviously it's beyond the scope of this one podcast, but it's really not that difficult. And there are a ton of great resources, both online and offline. Do a search, a Google search for, you know, basic electronics tutorial. I found like 5 right off the bat that are pretty good.
Oh, I like this first one. I'm just scanning down it, by the way, you guys. It has things like a picture of a closed circuit and an open circuit. And it's a real beautiful graphic of what it looks like. And this is cool. It's very visual.
Getting hands-on is also a great way to learn. And the way I did it is back in the day, you know, when Radio Shack was, back in its heyday.
That's where you have to stop, always shed a tear.
Yeah.
I bet that was a big tear for you. I'm guessing you were a fan.
Oh, yeah. I mean, pretty much every weekend I was there at our local Radio Shack. I knew all the guys, you know, they're all geeks, you know, back in.
Yeah.
And anyways, so Radio Shack used to sell these things I called N projects in one kits. Basically, there's these like little project boards that have all sorts of components on them, and they have these little sort of spring-loaded clip thingies, and that you connect everything up together with wires, and that way you can make various things. It comes with an instruction book that teaches you what all the components do and how they work, and lets you build cool things in the process.
Unfortunately, I bought one of those for my son Kyle. I don't think we ever played with him enough.
But
those are pretty cool.
They are pretty cool. Fortunately, there are some other companies that have taken up the slack, you know, now that sadly the Radio Shack is kind of, you know, no more. I found a couple of great ones. There's, you know, just look on Amazon. There's a company called Elenco that does all sorts of really, really cool things. They have a lot of these, you know, N projects in one kits. And, you know, when you get to more advanced levels, they actually have things that, you know, kits that you can solder together yourself, kind of like, you know, the old Heath kit, which is another way that people used to teach themselves. Unfortunately, that was a little before my time. Now, especially if you have children, there's also another cool thing called Little Bits, and I believe they started as a Kickstarter. I'm not sure about that, but now they're actually an actual product. Basically, what these are I kind of look akin to Legos for electronics. They have these little modules, and they literally snap together just like Legos, except, you know, they're designed so that they only snap together in the right way. You know, you can't connect, you know, the two negative terminals together or anything like that.
Okay.
And, you know, using these, you can make other, you know, cool little gadgets as well.
So it sounds like these would be the kind of things that would help get a kid excited, or you excited, about how things work and maybe want to take it to the next level.
Exactly. Yes.
Get the curiosity sparked, right?
Mm-hmm. And finally, believe it or not, getting your ham license is also an excellent way of learning about
what?
Basic electronics. Yeah. Basic electronics are still, I believe, a part of the ham licensing requirement. I mean, not totally in depth, just the basics. But also, hams are, I mean, they are the original geeks. They are the proto geeks. I mean, you know, they were the ones that have really started a lot of this, you know, they are the original makers as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, hanging around them, you know, you'll learn a ton.
Electronics will rub off on you.
Mm-hmm. And believe it or not, you know, even in our computerized, networked, digital world, radio, I think, is still not only relevant, but it's also still a lot of fun. And there you go, another possible topic for a later chit chat.
I do have to caution you that I chose mechanical engineering with absolute malice aforethought, avoided electrical engineering. So I sort of wish I knew about it, but they lost me when they said the electron went one direction and the electricity went the other direction. That just really bothered me.
It takes a little bit of wrapping your brain around, but
you have to believe in the square root of negative one as being something real or unreal. Anyway.
Okay. Anyways, now for the burning question, no pun intended. Do you need to learn how to solder? And the answer is no, you don't. Especially when you're just starting out. No soldering is involved at all. The cool thing is most circuits can be easily constructed using something called a breadboard, which is basically a little board with a bunch of holes in it. And you put, you know, put the wires through the holes to connect things up.
Do you tie them in a knot on the other side? How do you hold them in?
No, they actually have these little, they're like, I don't know, they're spring loaded or something. There's like some mechanism that
so they hold tight in the hole.
Yes.
Okay.
And make electrical contact that way.
Can you tell I do cross stitch?
Eventually, learning how to solder is a good idea. You know, sometimes you run into more advanced components that aren't breadboard friendly, or that maybe you need to solder some wires onto or some connectors or whatever. And
you
eventually
start without that skill, so that's
right,
cool.
Exactly. Yeah. So let's see. Just like as with computers, your fancy electronic projects are nothing more than a pile of parts. They need some sort of central brain in order to function as a unit. Technically, this is not entirely true. You can construct some simple circuits using only discrete, you know, components, but usually they're just simple things like LED blinky things and stuff. Okay. For the real stuff, you'll need some sort of brain. And there are two types that most people work with nowadays. We'll start with microcontrollers. So what these are they're small, relatively slow, relatively low power computer, you know, CPUs on it, you know, all on a single chip.
Okay.
Kind of akin to the older, you know, the older generation of CPUs, like the, you know, like the 6502 that the original Apple II used and stuff, you know.
Okay.
Pretty capable, you know, but not terribly powerful by today's standards. You have a limited number of I/O pins, which are basically
I/O pins.
Yeah, that are on the chip that you
What's
can
I/O?
Input output. That you can connect them to things, either analog or digital. So, you know, sensors, motors, LEDs.
So, like input speakers. Would be power, and output would be running the motor, for example.
Right.
Okay.
How do you hook up a whole bunch of different, you know, like what if you need, you know, like 10 light sensors, or a light sensor and a motion sensor and a temperature sensor or whatever. The way that this works nowadays is that most modern chips and sensors can actually be accessed over a kind of like a serial bus, kind of like USB, only much more simpler. And there's two ones that you'll see commonly, one called I2C and another called SPI. The good news is that you really don't have to deal with accessing these buses directly. Most of the
good, because you've completely lost me.
Yeah. Basically, we're not talking full on computers here. There's no operating system. There's no software libraries. There's no TCP/IP. There's no USB. You're basically programming the chip kind of at the bare metal level.
Okay.
So, and these are fairly small chips. You know, you're talking relatively low memory, in the Ks, not the megabytes or the gigabytes.
Oh, okay.
But these chips are also pretty energy efficient, which is great because, a lot of these projects you can run off of, you don't need to plug them in. You can run them off of little
AA battery or something?
Yeah, battery packs or something like that.
Okay, cool.
And the cool thing is, once you've designed your circuit, once you've programmed your chip, to do what you want it to do, you can take the chip out of the development board, slap it into a standalone circuit, which is really cool.
I'm having a little trouble visualizing what I'm going to be doing with this. Can you not to jump ahead too far, but maybe you can come back to where you are now. But what's an example of what you're talking about? What would we build?
Well, for example, it would be I know a guy who made a thing where if you knock on a door in a certain pattern, it'll actually open and unlock it.
Okay.
Yeah, there's some really cool things you can do.
All right. Okay, good. So, I needed some example to get excited.
So what these microcontrollers are good for are relatively simple tasks, reading sensors, controlling motors, outputting to simple LCD displays, that sort of thing. Nothing really complicated, no complex input output, they're not really well suited for doing complex input output like networking, Wi-Fi, large monitors, and definitely not like computing intensive tasks like, video streaming or encoding, that sort of thing.
All right.
So when you think about microcontrollers, the most common one you'll see nowadays is Arduino. It's pretty much the microcontroller, that du jour, but the thing is, technically, there is no microcontroller called Arduino. What this is that there's this guy, Massimo Barzi, hence the name Arduino. He's Italian. He said he was a teacher at the Interaction Design Institute in Ivnia, Italy. And he wanted a cheap way for artists to incorporate sort of digital interactive elements into their works, for example, like a dress that would, change color based on the sound that,
clap your hands and your dress changes from gold and white to black and blue.
Yeah, something like that.
Okay. How interesting for artists.
It's a really, really, really interesting concept. But once the makers and the hobbyists saw this, they kind of took to this thing
wildfire, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So what he did is he took a common, inexpensive microcontroller, the Atmel AVR, and he wrapped it in a user-friendly package. A development board, a software. The software that you use to write the programs. Kind of like the equivalent of Xcode. Where you have your editor and your compiler and all that stuff all wrapped into one package.
Okay. So he made it user-friendly.
Exactly.
Okay.
And another cool thing about Arduino is that it's an entire ecosystem. The Arduino, the layout of the connectors on the Arduino board is standardized. So there are many add-on boards called shields that you literally stack them on top of the Arduino, kind of like a hamburger patty, that add various bits of functionality. For example, wireless radio transmitters, servo motor controllers, sensors, small LCD screens, all sorts of cool things like that. And you can literally take these shields and literally stack them one on top of each other, you know, just like a hamburger pet, an electronic hamburger, to you know, come up with the device that you that does the things you want to do.
Would you call the Arduino project stuff open source?
Yes, the Arduino is an open source device. The board layout is, you know, is freely available. The compilers and the tools are all freely available. You know, if you had access to a board fabrication facility, you actually download the Arduino board specifications and have, you know, print one up. And there are companies that have made Arduino clone boards out there. And the cool thing is, again, you know, because it's a standard connector layout and stuff, all of the shields will work with the clone boards as well.
Neat.
It is really cool.
That's probably one of the coolest open source things out there, is that people are building things based on, like you say, you come up with some standards in that, and now you can be more creative because you're not spending time fighting over how it's done or anything like that.
Yeah, it's really cool, and you know, like, people have just been you know, adopting this thing by storm.
People are cool.
Yeah, there's some cool stuff going on. I'll you know, we'll get into some of the cool things, and you know, including some of the stuff I'm working on, you know, a little later.
Okay.
You'll see a couple other microcontrollers out there. Propeller makes a couple of interesting boards. Parallax is the company. One of their controllers is called the Propeller, and it's unique in that it's a multi-core microcontroller.
It's getting fancy.
Yeah, it has actually 8 cores in it, which is great if you have really demanding input output that you need. Like, let's say you need to, like, you know, read, you know, 5 or 6 different sensors, you know, in high speed, and you wanted to do it all, you know, without lag, you know, that'll be one, you know, one thing where you might need a little bit more powerful microcontroller like the Propeller. They also have one called the Basic Stamp, which is simpler, but it's programmed using a language very similar to Basic. So if you're already familiar with Basic, you know, that might be a great place to start as well.
Now we're literally talking my language.
There you go. And finally, there's another interesting chip called the TI MSP430, made by Texas Instruments. First of all, it is ridiculously cheap. The development board is only like $4, I think, and the chip itself is like pennies. It's smaller and a bit less powerful than the Atmel that's in the Arduino. It has less I/O, but it is extremely power efficient. I mean, you can run one of these things off of a coin cell battery for like months.
Okay.
So, you know, if you're looking for something.
Three different brains, Arduino, yeah, microcontrollers by Parallax, or the TI MSP430.
And there are lots of others out there as well. And each has their own sort of, you know, strengths and weaknesses.
Which one are you a fan of?
I'm a big fan of Arduino. I really like the environment and the community around it.
Yeah, it sounds really fun.
So now we move on to single board computers. And what a single board computer is, like the name implies, it's a board that combines most, if not all, of the functions and the peripherals found in a modern computer.
Hang on. So have we shifted from buying our own brain to buying something that's got a brain already on a board?
Yes.
Okay.
So, you know, you've got all the things that you're used to. You're some sort of video, you know, HDMI component, you know, composite, whatever, sound, USB, storage, like SD card or something, you know, all that on a single board.
Isn't that all the fun already done for me?
Yes and no. I mean, it basically, you're getting a lot more power that you can do more things. But
I'll just
still
go buy a whole computer and I got everything.
Yeah,
it seems to defeat the purpose to get it built for you.
No, because you know, one of these single board computers is a lot smaller than even a MacBook Air.
Okay. Well, I'll let you keep going, but I don't know if this newfangled buy-it-all-built thing is for me. So, I'm out there soldering and stuff by now.
So another benefit of the single-board computer is, because it's a full-on computer, you're actually running a full-on operating system, usually Linux, but there are some others, which means you have access to all of the programming, the scripting languages, code libraries, and so forth that a full OS has to offer.
Okay.
Most of these single board computers, though, they also have I/O pins on them, so that you can still connect to, you know, the things that you can on an Arduino, like sensors and motors and stuff. These are relatively large, physically, you know, relatively speaking, and relatively power hungry, again, relatively speaking. But you know, they're really the only way you can go if you need to do complex tasks, especially those that involve significant amounts of processing, network access, so forth. So audio, video streaming, face detection, or things that require a lot of storage, you know, because you have SD cards and USB that you could use, you know, USB flash drives, you know, storing and accessing a lot of data is much easier in a single board computer as opposed to something like an Arduino.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, and you can use them to do simpler tasks, things that Arduino can do, but it's probably overkill. It's like swatting a fly with a sledgehammer.
Okay.
So some notable examples, and the one that everyone, even, you know, even
Allison,
knows about is the Raspberry Pi.
Oh, okay. So that's considered a single board computer.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, so that's not overkill. Okay, I'm back with you.
Yeah. So this is a little device conceived by four guys at the University of Cambridge Computer Laboratory. And they basically were looking at the state of computer education. And they said, you know, we want to give people an inexpensive way to get kids interested in and learning about computers. So they made this little $35 board that, you know, all you have to do is, you know, just plug it into a monitor and a keyboard and you've got a full on computer there.
That's insane.
But, yeah, it's amazing. But, you know, what, of course, as happens in these cases, it was quickly adopted by the hobbyists and the makers and stuff because
they swarmed over it, I bet.
Yeah, because it's, you know, it's really, really inexpensive and, but, you know, pretty powerful as well. As far, you know, compared to your desktop computer, it's still relatively low powered. Uses the older ARM V6 architecture, but it's also very inexpensive.
Can you make a Hackintosh out of it?
Not quite. they just literally last month, February, announced the Raspberry Pi 2, which is largely addressed shortcomings of the first Raspberry Pi. They moved to a chip based on the new ARM 7 architecture, and it's also a multi-core chip, so it's also really, really powerful. And
so the shortcomings were it was low power or
low power,
inefficient or
low power, inefficient, relatively slow.
Okay.
Unfortunately, the Pi 2s are still in relatively short supply, so I haven't had a chance to play with one yet.
On order?
I do, yes.
Okay.
Another cool thing about the Pi is that it too, you know, like the Arduino, it also has a standard pin layout, which means you can actually design boards that stack onto the Pi just like the Arduino shields. And there are several companies that have made boards such as this, touchscreen LCDs, high quality audio input, you know, input output, and so forth. Not quite as many as the Arduino shields, but you know the number is growing. Now you'll also hear about a microcomputer, a single board computer called the BeagleBone Black. This is based on another board called the Beagle Board, confusing, I know, which is a development board made by Texas Instruments. They basically engineered this thing from the ground up for the hobbyist market. And they managed to lower the price to make it competitive with the Pi. The BeagleBone Black is $45, which is $10 more than the Pi. But this board is also more powerful than the Pi. It's got a faster CPU. It has a lot more I/O pins, so you can connect a lot more stuff to it and so forth. And it, too, you know, has a standard pin layout, you know. These designers were smart. They actually, you know, they decided to standardize on their pin layouts so that way there are companies that were able to come up with add-on boards called capes that, you know, just like the Arduino shields, they stack right on top of the BeagleBone and add additional functionality.
Is it BeagleBone or BeagleBoard?
BeagleBone.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay. BeagleBone Black is the device, but BeagleBoard is the company.
BeagleBoard is the device that they based it on.
Okay, yeah, I see why you say it was confusing. So is this one being adopted by the maker community as much?
It is now. When they first came out, they had some supply issues, but those have been overcome.
Okay.
Yeah.
But why would one go to this over the Raspberry Pi then?
Now that the Pi 2 is out, you know, we'll have to see. But compared to the Pi that's out right now, the BeagleBone Black is a lot more powerful. It uses the more modern ARM7 chip. Okay. It has, you know, it's faster. It has more input output pins, so you can connect it to more stuff and so forth.
Okay, but if the community isn't there, that's a big downside, right?
Yeah, but the community is there now. It's really grown.
Okay, so the community is fickle enough to adopt the coolest thing?
Yeah, well really it's whatever works for your project. You know, for example, we'll talk, in fact, we'll getting into this in the next section, but when you talk about the camera project that I did, I would probably, you know, if I had it to do over again, I probably would have went with the BeagleBone Black because it might have allowed me to, you know, do faster encodes to get a, you know, better frame rate out of my camera.
Okay. Well, is this open source?
Yeah, I believe it is. I believe it is, yes.
Even though TI developed it, they made it open source.
Yeah.
Huh. What's their motivation?
I think they just want to get people to use their chip.
Oh, okay. Oh, because it uses their chip.
Right.
There you go. Okay. Huh.
So you're probably wondering by now, what can you do with this stuff? So to give you the ideas of the kinds of things you can do, the kinds of sensors and other, you know, things that out there that you can connect up, I picked a few scenarios, either ones that I've done personally or I know people who've done. So let's start with something that we talked about recently, quadcopters.
Ooh.
It always comes back to quadcopters. So obviously the problem to be solved here is to stay in the air. You know, we talked about quadcopters, you know, they're aerodynamically unstable by nature. So unless you have something that's managing the thrust of all four motors, you're going to fall out of the sky.
Okay.
And this thing that does that is called the flight controller board. Believe it or not, most quadcopters boards use simple microcontrollers for this. When you boil it all down, a flight controller is basically taking input from a bunch of sensors, you know, your accelerometer, gyroscope, compass, and so forth, doing some relatively simple calculations to determine, you know, how fast should I spin motor one, how fast should I spin motor two, and so forth, and, you know, sending the appropriate commands to the motors. This is well within the capabilities of most, just about any microcontroller. The two boards that I talked about, you know, when we were talking about quadcopters, the KK board and the Flip MWC, both of those are using the Atmel AVR, which is the same chip that the Arduino uses. In fact, the Flip MWC is actually programmed using the Arduino software.
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's pretty cool.
But it is an Arduino, or it's just using the software from Arduino?
It's using the Arduino software.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Huh.
So now we come to a project that I'm currently working on right now, which I'm tentatively calling You've Got Mail. So the problem to be solved here.
Such a dork, not a little.
I know.
And you embrace your dorkness.
Exactly. So the problem to be solved here is our mail carrier is somewhat unreliable.
For the love of Pete. Mine comes anywhere between 9 in the morning and 8 at night. I mean, I'm serious. It's 8 at night.
Yeah, it's like those. It's like, you know, when you get a service call, you know, it's like, we'll be there sometime between 8 in the morning and 8 at night. Great. Thanks.
Will you be home in July?
Exactly. So I want to know when they come because, well, you know, I'm waiting for my Amazon package. I don't want to, you know, go out every 5 minutes. Is he there yet?
Yeah. Oh, I might want this one. Okay.
Or sometimes, you know, maybe I have a package they want to send out, you know, that I want to hand it to him. The secondary problem is that there have been reports in our neighborhood of people, mail being tampered with, you know, people, you know, reaching in and swiping mail. So I wanted to figure out a way to detect when the mailbox was opened. So I came up with this system that I've actually breadboarded out. So and I've done some field tests, and it actually works quite well. I'll be doing a write up on the blog hopefully within the next few days.
Oh, cool.
Anyways, so this is composed of two Arduinos. One is located inside the mailbox at the very back of it, and the other one's on my desk. So the one in the mailbox reads input from a photoresistor, which is a device that measures the amount of light that's hitting it. So, you know, once the light level has passed a certain threshold, that I know, hey, the mailbox door has been opened. So
I see a flaw in this, Donald. My guy comes at 9 at night. Oh, my overhead light's on though.
Yeah, we have a street light that's like right above our mailbox.
Okay.
So once it passes, you know, that threshold, it knows that the mailbox door has been open. So then it sends a signal to the other Arduino, which this is where it gets a little even geekier. So on the Arduino on my desk, it, you know, receives the mailbox open signal.
Is that over Wi-Fi?
It's actually using a radio transmitter called the NRF24L01.
Oh, even better.
Yeah, it's kind of like it's like simplified Wi-Fi, you know, because you don't need full on HTML or TCP/IP. You're just sending a hey, I'm open or hey, I'm closed signal. So you can do that using just simple radio.
Right.
Anyway, so the Arduino on my desk receives that signal and it sounds a buzzer when the mailbox is open.
Awesome.
I also decided to stick a real-time clock on it so that way you could record what time the mailbox was opened. And it keeps a log of the last 10 openings. And finally, it has a little LCD display on it that I can use to scroll through the last few log entries. Yeah, that last flourish was a bit overkill, but it was fun.
Oh, you're such a... I like it.
Yeah.
But now, hey, if you wanted to call your post office and say, dude, what is with this guy? You have a log to say he came at 8:07, he came at 6 in the morning, you know, you could totally use that.
Yeah, exactly. So now we come to another project that I'm calling the secret knock detector. And we talked a little bit about this before. Basically, there was a guy...
I just thought of another good use is you're taking a nap and he comes when you're napping, so you didn't see you missed the buzzer.
Exactly, yeah.
So you could go check the log and go, yeah. Oh, look, he came while I was sleeping. Or
right, good point. So with this knock detector we talked about a little earlier, it's something cool that some guys thought up, basically to be able to restrict access to something using a non-obvious method, you know, something not like a key card or a access card or anything like that. In this case, they thought, wouldn't it be fun to make something that'll open up something based on a secret knock pattern? So the way this works is it's Arduino based, which really shows the versatility of the things that you can do with an Arduino. So you've got a piezoelectric sensor, which is basically a sensor that detects changes in pressure, in this case caused by someone knocking. It sends these information to an Arduino, which analyzes the knock pattern and compares it to the known access granted pattern that's been programmed into it. And if they match, then what the Arduino does is it sends a message to a servo motor, which is a motor that, you know, regular motors, you know, you turn them on, they start spinning, you turn them off, they stop spinning. What a servo motor is it's actually a motor that you can tell it to move to spin a discrete amount of revolutions. So that way, you know, you can actually use it to precisely control something. So in this case, the servo motor will actually activate the deadbolt lock, for example, if it was a door, you know.
So if you wanted it to turn 90 degrees, for example.
Exactly, yes.
Huh. Okay.
Now, next part.
But we all know that you're going to do dot, 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 dot.
Yeah. So next project is something that I worked on as part of my company, and it's called the do-it-yourself weather station. Just doesn't really have an official name yet, but basically we recently exhibited at the AMS Weather Fest in in Phoenix. Our goal, we wanted to promote the use of free and open source software and hardware. So we decided to create a weather station that basically, you know, and can be easily assembled using off-the-shelf components. So we started with some sensors. We started with a some temperature sensors, barometric pressure sensors, humidity sensor, and a lightning sensor, which is really cool. So the nice thing about all these sensors is they communicate over this I2C bus. So it was possible to hook all of them up, you know, to whatever device we decided to run this thing using only two wires. You know, again, you know, there you're talking, because you don't have a lot of I/O pins, you know that's a major concern. But because all of these sensors were talking over the I2C bus, you know, we didn't have to worry about that. So, you know, now we come to, you know, what device did we want to drive this thing? You know, we thought about maybe an Arduino, but we ended up going with the Raspberry Pi instead because of several things. The first thing is we wanted to, we wanted ease of to make this easy to program. So we wanted, you know, because the Pi is a full-on computer, you know, it's running Linux, and we were able to use Python, which is a scripting language, to you know, do the code that reads the data from the sensors and stores it in a local database. Also, the Pi was running a web server along with an Ajax web interface that displayed the data real time on a web browser. Hmm. You know, and that's, you know, because we're talking about, you know, TCP/IP, Wi-Fi. You know, we needed something more powerful than an Arduino. And that was really the only reason why we went with the Pi, is because we wanted to run, you know, we wanted to run that web server on it and have it accessible over the network, you know, Ethernet or Wi-Fi. If all we wanted to do was just display the sensor data, we could have done that using the Arduino and just a small little, 16x2 line LCD screen.
So what kind of screen did you guys put on the weather station? I mean,
so on the weather station, what we have is a screen from Adafruit Industries, which is basically a little, pretty small. It's a little LCD. It's a 3.5-inch LCD, but it also has a touch screen.
Wow.
So we actually wrote a little interface where on the Pi itself, you could actually touch little buttons, you know, read the temperature, read the pressure, or whatever. But it was also serving that data via a web page.
Wait a minute. You just finished telling me that we weren't going to be doing anything that was going to use TCP/IP and all that, and all of a sudden you're serving up web pages.
Well, that's the reason why we went with the Raspberry Pi as opposed to the Arduino, because the Pi is, you know, it's basically a single board computer. You know, it has a full operating system. It has Linux on it, and you know, you have your full TCP/IP stack, and, you know, USB, Wi-Fi, all that good stuff.
Okay.
So now we get to the project that sort of sparked your interest, the do-it-yourself motion detecting internet accessible streaming security camera.
Right. Okay, I'm going to jump to my favorite part of this. Is at the end, what Donald did after he made this camera was apparently you can buy fake security cameras. All they have is an LED. And you said buy one of those and stick yours inside it. Now you've got a nice looking case.
Because they're basically hollow inside. So yeah, just enough room to stick the Raspberry Pi in there.
I love A, that they exist, and B, that you snaked it and said, look, I can make it. Now I've got a case for it.
Exactly. So the problem to be solved here is we have some neighborhood hooligans that have done, you know, some kind of naughty things, vandalizing our yard. And in one case, believe it or not, making off with one of our plants.
What?
Yeah,
oh, I've heard about plant theft.
Of all the strange things. So we wanted to catch them in the act. And also, while we're at it, you know, it might be nice to be able to monitor parts of the house while we're out of town, you know, keep an eye on our pets and, you know, keep an eye on the property and so forth. Now, there's some great cameras out there, drop cam being one of the most popular, but it's, you know, each of those is $200. Mm. And plus you have to subscribe to a monthly service to get the full benefit.
Really? Oh, yeah. That's lame.
So what I decided to do is I got a Raspberry Pi with the Raspberry Pi camera module, which is a really cool little module, little camera board that docks right onto the Pi itself. It's really small and pretty cool, and it's still an HD camera. It's pretty neat. I loaded Linux on the thing, and then I loaded an open source program called Motion, which is a motion detecting software.
Oh, cool.
So basically it's, you know, looking at the camera, and whenever it detects motion, it starts recording video.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Yeah.
So, being that it's me here, I decided to add some embellishments. So I wrote my own web interface on top of this thing that basically lets you stream the live picture from a desktop or a mobile device, as well as watching past recordings.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And how much did it cost you to build this whole thing?
Let's see. The Pi was $35. The camera module was $20. The software is free. I needed an SD card, which is like $2 now.
Right.
So well under $100.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, so you say camera module. How good of a camera is that?
It's a full HD camera.
Huh. I guess we've got those little bitty HD cameras inside our phones and everything now.
Yeah,
right?
Basically I believe it uses a camera module that you'd find on a cell phone.
Yeah. Huh. I guess those are good enough.
So obviously the reason why I went to the Pi is because I needed some power, to be able to do motion tracking. That's a little beyond the abilities of an Arduino microprocessor. I also needed the Wi-Fi and the USB, so that I can make this thing available over the internet.
Wow. Now you put a link to the web interface, but it's actually a link to the downloadable source code that you put up on GitHub that you
yes.
wrote? Okay. I thought I was going to get to see your webcam.
Well, I put a link to my video as well, so people can check that out.
Oh, okay. We're looking for it. Where'd you put that? I see the motion detection software.
It's the title. Do it yourself.
Ah. Oh, I didn't even notice that was a title. Okay, cool.
So as you can see, we can do some pretty cool things with these devices. Hopefully this will incite some of you out there to do some cool things. It's fun to experiment, and who knows, you might end up creating a product that you might want to develop. You never know.
Yeah, this really does look fun. You're in danger here that I might get one, and then I'm going to be on the horn with you right away going, well, now how do I do this, Donald? How do we do that?
Anytime.
What if you don't know how to program, though? Is it still fun?
Oh yeah, oh yeah. With the Arduino, all of these devices have huge communities around them, and so because they're open source, also it's people have adopted the whole open source share and enjoy attitude. So you find there's a ton of code out there and examples of people building things, and they show how it's done and put up the code, so you can take that and run with it.
A lot of people say that society is dying because in the old days we would all band together to help Sally raise her barn. The people who knew how to nail boards together would get it, get their part of it done, and somebody else would bake pies for the people who were working, and everybody worked together. And people say, well, that kind of thing would never happen these days. But I think this is exactly where it's happening. Is our human nature is still to help each other do stuff when we know how to do things.
Yeah.
And so we share information, except it's on an open source community, maybe, or something like that. That's very cool.
It is really cool.
All right. Let's see. You've got a couple of links in here, too, or quite a few links in here to other places where people can find information.
Yeah. And one of the more interesting ones is makerspaces or hackerspaces. What these are is real life places scattered all across the world.
Wait, mean physical, where you talk to people in real life?
Exactly.
That's kind of crazy.
You can meet other makers, socialize, get help, and so forth. But the cool thing about makerspaces is they also, a lot of them have outfitted themselves with specialized equipment, electronics test equipment. equipment, soldering stations, things to do welding if you're doing you know, larger projects, CNC machines, you know, electronic routers that you can use to make custom cases for your projects and so forth.
I know what CNC means. It's numerical control machine. Yeah.
Basically, you know, things that us, you know, 3D printers, stuff like that, things that us individuals might not be able to afford or keep in our home, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, people basically bring these things to their maker spaces and they make them available for people to use.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, that's really cool.
A lot of them are free. Some of them are, you know, have a small membership fee, but it's you know, pretty reasonable. And it's just a great place to get together and, you know, share ideas and get help on things and you know, so forth.
This sounds really, really fun. So you put a link to hackerspaces.org where you can go find those?
Exactly.
Wow. And you've got just a whole bunch more links in here. I noticed you had a section in the notes that just says, here's a whole bunch of links of stuff you might need. Yeah. Stick it somewhere in the show notes.
Yeah. So I just want to go quickly through a couple others.
Okay.
Maker fairs. If you have one in your area, go to it. These are basically public gatherings. You know, they're like kind of like you know, public science fairs where, you know, makers from all across the globe bring their stuff and show it off. There's also, you know, people come there to teach, you know, like you could learn how to solder, you could learn how to, you know, do basic electronics. These are great places. They have them. I know there's one up north in the Bay Area. There's one here in LA. They have them several around the country as well. If you can get yourself to a maker fair, definitely do so because it's really cool.
Oh, that does sound fun.
No, the Ben Heck Show is a great podcast. Ben Heck is basically, he got his fame modding consoles like PlayStations and Xboxes, but every week he makes all sorts of cool gadgets. And one thing I really like about Ben is he does a lot of stuff for accessibility. For example, he regularly modifies game console controllers to make them accessible to people with physical impairments and stuff.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So, but you know, watching his show, you get some cool ideas of the kinds of things you can build as well. And there's some great places where you can not only buy stuff, you know, the stuff like the Arduinos and the parts and all that, but also get, you know, they also have communities around them, you know, where you can ask questions, get ideas, talk to other people. You know, Adafruit is a really great one. Lady Ada, her real name escapes me at the moment, but she's, you know, she's one of the great, you know, women in technology nowadays, that she's putting herself out there and really.
I like the play on words with that, because that's probably Ada Lovelace combined with fruit, the Raspberry Pi. You can see all kinds of puns in there.
Yeah. So Adafruit, Spark Fun, Element 14. Those are some great places to buy all the parts, but also to, you know, to talk with other builders.
Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, get out there and make stuff.
Well, this is cool. If people have gotten involved and they want to show off their work, how would they get a hold of you, Donald, to let you know about it?
I'm on the Twitters as DBurr. I also have my blog, donaldburr.com, which I'm actually starting to post to again.
Oh, there's a new thing.
Yeah. I actually have posted the other talk that I did at Scale. I'll put a link to that as well. And finally, if you have any interest at all in Japanese culture, anime, animation, manga, food, travel, check out my podcast at otakunopodcast.com.
Awesome, Donald. This was really, really fun. What I don't understand is how we got it done so quickly.
I know.
I saw your show notes. I was like, okay, you're going to solve world peace in here too.
Yeah, I went crazy with the show notes as usual.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, we'll probably have a link to those. I like the idea of having those over on your site so we drive some traffic your way too.
All right, will do.
All right, thanks a lot for coming, Donald.
Awesome. Have a nice day.
Well, I always have a good time with Donald, and I hope you guys enjoyed that too. But you know what? That's going to wind us up for this week. Many thanks to our sponsor for helping to pay the bills, the makers of Clarify over at clarify-it.com. Don't forget to send in your audio recordings to Bart at podcasting@bartificer.net. And hopefully, I will be tweeting over the next 3 weeks, so you can follow me on Twitter at Podfeet. Check out the new Silicast Google Plus community, too. We have so much fun over there. Lots of good information. New people jumping in all the time. We're pushing 500 people in there, and that's huge growth. I mean, the number of people joining is really going up, and that's a lot of fun. Remember, no live show for the next three Sunday nights, so you will not be able to join the friendly and enthusiastic Nosilla Castaways. Who knows, though? Sometimes they just go hang out in the chat room without me. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.